The country added more than 200,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate is 5%. But in Arizona, that's not the case, with fewer new jobs.
Even though they're recovering, they are still, I would say, in terms of overall labor market tightness, are probably furthest away from normal labor market conditions.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the Maricopa Community Colleges will be looking for a new chancellor, helping students at One Phoenix High School stay on track to get their caps and gowns.
Arizona drivers pay lower than average auto insurance rates.
And an Arizona coyote and his dog.
He's a service dog, and he can actually sense my butt hair gets out of range, and he alerts me, and he's right 99.9% of the time.
Plus, students show off their engineering prowess, and a unique Tempe house reopens.
That and more on the show, after a check of this hour's news.
Good Friday afternoon. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. Quickly checking Valley traffic. U.S. 60 eastbound, a crash at Priest on the side of the road. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 74 degrees. 68 is average for today. Partly cloudy tonight with overnight lows in the mid-40s. And then sunny for the weekend with highs of 74 tomorrow, 77 on Sunday. Right now it's sunny, 70 degrees at KJZZ.
The outgoing CEO of Valley Metro has reportedly agreed to a separation agreement with the agency. He submitted a letter of resignation last week after the release of public records about questionable business expenses. KJZZ's Alexander Olgan reports the boards of Valley Metro accepted his resignation on Thursday.
The separation agreement hasn't yet been formalized. That's scheduled to happen Monday. If outgoing CEO Stephen Banta and the board sign the current deal, he would be compensated through the rest of December. Records show that Banta used public funds for expensive dinners, first-class flights, and alcohol. Banta said he will cooperate with both audits because he has nothing to hide. In addition, Phoenix Councilman Michael Nowakowski is calling for an attorney general investigation.
I'm not against the trips, but it's the expenses on the trips. If you're going out there to do some research, if there's a community purpose for it, I think you should. But if you're spending hundreds of dollars on a dinner and drinking, there's something wrong with that.
Nowakowski says he has traveled to research public transit but has no concerns about his expenses. The AG's office will look into the complaint to decide whether to launch an investigation. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The U.S. Labor Department says the country added 211,000 jobs last month and that the national unemployment rate held at 5%. Arizona, by contrast, reported an unemployment rate in October of 6.1%. To get a sense of what this morning's report means for the country and for Arizona, we turn to Gad Levinon, Managing Director of Macroeconomic and Labor Market Research at the Conference Board. And Gad, what do you make of the numbers?
So I think it's another confirmation that job growth is continuing to be solid. I think that the implications are that the labor market is going to continue to tighten significantly if job growth continues at that rate. I expect the unemployment rate to reach 4.5% by the end of 2016, about a year from now. And then as a result, I think we're on the way of seeing faster wage growth.
Are you seeing the same level of job growth across the country? Are there certain regions that are doing better than others?
There are some, there are several kind of different trends happening at the same time. So there are two, I would say, main industries that are suffering right now. So things related to mining, especially oil and gas, are suffering. And manufacturing in general is also not doing very well because of the strengthening of the dollar and the weakness in the rest of the world. Our exports are growing very slowly, if at all. So areas that don't have much manufacturing or mining are actually seeing better growth now. Areas that have mining or manufacturing in them in a significant way are growing more slowly. When it comes to the west or the southwest, so certainly in Texas and other oil producing states, we see slower job growth or even negative in some cases. The west and the southwest are benefiting from the fact that there isn't that much manufacturing there compared to the Midwest, for example, or some states in the south where manufacturing is still a big part of those states.
So did you find that states like Arizona are sharing in the relative prosperity of the country as a whole?
Well, So Arizona in particular, they have seen a significant recovery, but Arizona was one of the states that was hit the most during the recession. Arizona and Nevada, probably the two states that suffered the most. So even though they're recovering, they are still, I would say, in terms of overall labor market tightness, are probably furthest away from normal labor market conditions. So even though there has been a recovery, there are still long way to go before you see tight labor markets in Arizona and Nevada.
Do you think it's realistic to expect that Arizona would have an unemployment rate of 4.5% by the end of next year?
No. In Arizona, no. 6.1% to have a 1.6% drop in 1 year, I think it would be very remarkable if that happens.
Of the jobs that have been added, are these what economists like to call good jobs or the well-paying jobs, benefits, skilled jobs?
Many of them are. So it's pretty much across the board we see job increases. The share of people who are working part-time is a kind of dropping as more people find a full-time job. Not in the last months, but I would say in the past couple of years, the number of people who want a full-time job but could only find a part-time job is shrinking dramatically because more and more people are able to find full-time jobs. So I would say in general, the increase in job growth is pretty much across the board.
Gad Levenon is Managing Director of Macroeconomic and Labor Market Research at the Conference Board in New York. We are talking about the release this morning of the nation's jobs report. Gad, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Arizona is one of two states that has a Medicaid waiver pending before the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Michigan is the other. The Kaiser Family Foundation this week released a report in which it looked at what CMS signed off on in the six states who have had their waivers approved. To talk about it, I'm joined by Robin Rudowitz, Associate Director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. So, Robin, are there any themes you were able to pick out in those six states?
Well, I think some of the themes that we've seen in the waivers that have been approved are a number of states are seeking to impose premiums or monthly contributions, particularly for individuals above the poverty line. And we're also seeing that states are interested in applying some of these healthy behavior incentives, and we're seeing how states are implementing those as well as how beneficiaries respond.
Is there anything that you have found that the feds are almost universally likely to reject that states have tried to do?
Looking at the waivers that have been approved, we see some of the common themes that CMS has been willing to look at in terms of bending some federal rules, but we're also seeing where they've put some lines in the sand in terms of things that they will not approve. And through guidance and other discussions with states, we've seen that CMS has said that they would deny waiver approval related to monthly contributions that would be a condition of eligibility for individuals below the poverty level. They said that they would deny waivers that would impose an enrollment cap or a work requirement as a condition of eligibility. Those are some of the things that CMS has said that they would not approve.
Is there anything that you have seen so far in the applications that have been approved that leads you to think what may or may not be approved in Arizona's application?
Well, there are some provisions that were included in the Arizona application, waiver application that's pending with CMS now, like a five-year limit on Medicaid benefits for able-bodied adults. That is something that CMS has never approved in a waiver before, this five-year limit, as well as a work requirement. The state is also seeking a work incentive program that would not be a condition of eligibility. So CMS might look at that provision, but they have said in the past that they would not approve a waiver that has a work requirement as a condition of eligibility.
Is CMS able to approve certain provisions and reject others, or is it an all or nothing kind of proposition?
No, waivers are typically a negotiation process back and forth with the state and CMS. So typically the waiver that's approved may not look like the waiver that was submitted.
In looking at some of the other things that Arizona is asking for, it looks like, based on what you said earlier, that some of them could well be approved, including some of the healthy living incentives and some kind of a monthly premium. Does it seem like some of those could be good to go in some form?
Well, you know, it's always hard to say, and I think CMS also looks at where a state is starting from. So with some of the other waivers that have been approved, the discussion has been around whether or not to implement the expansion. It is unclear how CMS might view the application and waiver application from Arizona, given that they've already implemented the expansion. So they might be interested in seeing how that would affect enrollees that are currently enrolled in the expansion. So that would be a change for them, whereas some of the other waivers were newly implementing the expansion. So we'll have to see how that is interpreted by CMS.
Robin Rudowitz is an associate director for the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Robin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today is the deadline to submit comments to the Arizona Department of Transportation on a master transportation plan that would affect the communities of Sedona, Cottonwood, and Camp Verde, among other places. Sedona is also getting to work on its own master plan, which, considering the city's uniqueness, comes with special challenges. Andy Dickey, Sedona City Engineer and Assistant Community Development Director, gave us an explanation.
When you're talking about planning for traffic or transportation, whether it's specifically Sedona or just the outlying areas, what are some of the unique challenges to that when you're dealing with a place that is known for being so beautiful and so unique?
Some of the bigger challenges are related to tourism. Typically, in a town our size, you're looking at your main traffic coming from commuting and just interactive traffic within the city. However, what we see are large volumes of traffic on the weekends and during certain seasons and special events. Those kind of things are sometimes hard to plan for.
Well, so when you are putting together a new master plan, what are some of the things you need to keep in mind? Because you presumably don't want to turn off tourists, but you also don't want to turn off the residents that are there all the time.
Correct. So you really need to look at the overall, you know, year and see when you truly are getting the maximum amount of traffic. And you have to account for those times as well as your commuter traffic and kind of the more frequent high volumes of traffic that you see on a day-to-day basis.
Is there a certain time of year when things get busier? Or because some of us would think, well, in the summer, you want to get away from the valley heat. But as I said, the holidays must really bring a lot of people there as well.
That's correct. Holidays bring traffic. Really, the times of the year that we see the most traffic are during the springtime, you know, around spring break and around the fall. Those are really the highest tourism times for us, as well as the related traffic that we see with that.
Are there certain options that you hear from the public, and are there certain options that you and other folks who are actually planning this stuff consider in order to relieve some of the congestion? Are there unique ideas? Are there ideas that other communities have used that you may be considering right now?
There certainly are unique ideas. There are some ideas that, you know, we might want to pave Schnebley Hill Road, for instance, and there are a lot of challenges related to that. And you really have to look at, you know, what the benefit is in relation to the cost that you're, you know, putting into that and that particular improvement. And some of the more unique ideas may not quite be coming out as a, you know, cost effective and really getting to what the true issue is. You know, you might get a little bit of relief of congestion, but not to the level that people think that you might.
Do you ever get the impression that people who come visit Sedona sort of put it out of their minds that there are actually people here working on a daily basis that, you know, maybe they don't want to see you jaywalk, maybe they don't want you to drive so slowly through their town, or just congest their town?
There definitely are those people here that would they would prefer to see no economic growth, see Sedona stay as small as possible, and kind of interfere with their lives as little as possible. And then we have the other side of the community that would like to see the city, you know, prosper economically and grow in ways. But I think everybody agrees that we don't want to see congestion continue to get worse.
Andy Dickey, Sedona City Engineer and Assistant Community Development Director. Coming up, we'll find out from Maricopa County Community College District Chancellor Rufus Glasper why he's retiring and moving on to another job. Stay tuned, it's the show.
Good afternoon, it is the show with Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway collision at 40th Street, 202 westbound, a crash at State Route 51. 72 degrees at 219.
KJZZ is supported by Free Arts of Arizona, helping abused and homeless children through artistic expression. Now accepting foster care tax credit donations. Learn more about how you can help children heal through creativity. FreeArtsAZ.org.
The Maricopa County Community College District will be undergoing a huge leadership change soon. Chancellor Rufus Glasper, who's been in the post for 13 years, is retiring from that job to take the president and CEO position with the Valley-based League for Innovation in the Community College. Now, Chancellor Glasper, why is it the time to move on?
As I look at what's happening with the landscape here in Arizona and nationally, and I have an opportunity to take some of the initiatives and challenges that we have here in Arizona and that we have been working on in Maricopa in the space of student success, innovation, funding. I have an opportunity now to take that to a national audience, and that excites me.
Is there a feeling that the way the community colleges have been governed, in a sense, has become more politicized recently? And has that made the job bumpier? Has it made it harder to get across the goals you'd like because people running for election might have different points of view, or they might have different agendas?
I believe that all of government is at the congressional level and at the state level has become more politicized. And I believe that community colleges are caught up in that national change. And what has happened within our own space is that we need to begin to look at, first and foremost, the mission of our institution, who we're serving, why we're serving them, and that if the community colleges are not there to provide this service, then where do our students go? We need to revisit the notion of a social justice argument. The social justice argument is saying that we support the underserved, the first generation, and I think we're losing that when we begin to focus on downsizing, right-sizing, less government, and less service.
The district went through a major security breach a couple of years ago that could have affected 2 million people and has cost the district millions of dollars. Could that have been prevented? And have fixes been put in place where you feel confident that going forward, this is as unlikely as possible to ever happen again?
I am extremely excited as to where we are now in relationship to the security incident. We have learned many different lessons. And one of your questions was, could it have been avoided? I think that what I've learned is that we are being attacked on a daily basis by people trying to find ways into systems and specifically educational institutions. I believe we could have been better prepared. I think that we took initial steps to prepare us. We didn't take it as seriously as we should have. Moving forward, we need to be cognizant of the fact that we have a business case that we need to support, but we need to be more cognizant of the fact that we need to protect personal identifiable information, we need to protect the system, and we need to fund a system appropriately to have that protection.
The district has really been a pioneer when it comes to online learning. And now that we have big universities in Arizona and across the country that have decided they want to jump in, seeing this as a good practice, how has that affected the challenges of online learning for the district? Has the district been able, you sometimes when you're a pioneer, you're not quite as aware of what other people are doing. Has the district, if the district has been caught up to, has the district had new ideas going forward? Has it been a little stagnant when it comes to online learning?
I doubt if it has been stagnant. What has happened is with online learning growing in many places within Arizona and nationally, online learning within Maricopa has become more displaced into other community colleges within Maricopa and less so at Rio. So I think part of what we need to look at is how do we serve our students here in the Valley with online needs, and how do we serve them with a diverse platform of Rio's model versus our other nine colleges. But then what are the opportunities? And I would say that, quite frankly, a lot of our opportunities for the most part will be external to Arizona, international in many places. And when you take the largest two-year online in the country, which is the space that Rio owns now, that we need to use that to our advantage, and we need to develop some new models that say we are here. Mm-hmm. This is what we can provide. And there's a population of students that are in the two-year space that I think we can own.
Rufus Glasper, longtime Maricopa County Community College District Chancellor, who announced his retirement earlier this week.
Valley of the Sun United Way is trying to make sure Central High School students stay on track to get their diplomas. The graduation destination program matches volunteer mentors with students to identify their needs and get them additional support. Joining me to talk about this are Alexis Guzman, who's a 2015 graduate of Central High. He's now enrolled at the Maricopa Skills Center. And Michelle Donati. She works at AAA Arizona and is in her fourth year of mentoring. So, Alexis, how do you get hooked up with this program?
It all started back my freshman year, I want to say. They started handing out tutors to classrooms, and specifically they chose my classroom because I happen to be one of the classrooms with most of the students that were really lagging behind.
In your freshman year, before you started getting the tutoring, I mean, how were things going for you in school?
I had self-confidence that I would be able to make it to graduation and I would have that graduation. But yet again, I always had the doubt in the back of my head that maybe there was things that I can improve on myself. So I always try to ask for help and lean on others to probably get the same goal done.
Michelle, what does your mentoring look like? I mean, what do you do when you're meeting with these students?
Sure. So United Way provides mentors with a curriculum, and but at the same time, they give us some flexibility. So if you know students are asking for something else, we have the liberty to go and research and deliver that something else to them. So, you know, for example, this year with my class, we did a brainstorming exercise where I asked them, "What do you want to learn about this year? Like, what can I help you with?" So we just did a lesson a couple of weeks ago on career options in law enforcement and the military. There were several students in my class who were very interested in a career in either of those fields. And so we were able to talk about how a career in one of those fields could help lead to higher education and lead to financing higher education.
Alexis, what do you think was the biggest thing, or maybe the couple of biggest things that you got out of being a part of this program?
Besides expanding my network, I feel like I gained a friend, Mr. Reaper, who was my mentor at the time. He did exactly the same mission that she's trying to do. They don't really just stick into the classrooms and try to teach you knowledge that you need to graduate. He actually impacted my life. He always showed me that if you don't aim too high, then you're aiming too low. So he became the friend that I've needed, and then he kind of motivated me to just believe in myself and be better.
It kind of sounds like you got almost more out of this in the sense of skills, not like learning classroom skills, but just sort of life skills and sort of learning how to learn and how to sort of make your way in the world.
Yeah, and he knew I was a very close person. You know, I have troubles trusting people, and he found a way to do that. Nobody asked him to. It wasn't in his title. He didn't have to do that, but he chose to do that.
Michelle, how do you try to help each individual student? You're in front of a class of X number of students, and each one has different needs, different ways of learning. How do you try to make sure that you're reaching each student?
You know, that can be a pretty big challenge, and, you know, class sizes do vary. And then you have some students who are more outspoken than others. And so one of the ways I've tried to do that over the years has been really just kind of going off of consensus. So, for example, asking my students to do this brainstorming exercise. So that way I heard from everyone and I can try to integrate into those specific areas throughout the year. But in terms of a one-on-one, one of the ways that the program has evolved over the years is that this year we've introduced report card conferences. And so what this does is it gives volunteers and mentors the opportunity to sit down with students individually in their classrooms and to go through their grades with them. And if a student is excelling, then we can let them know they're doing a great job and ask them if there's absolutely anything that we can do to continue to support them in that way. But if a student's falling behind, we can work with them individually to make a plan to get them back on track.
From your perspective, being on the inside of this program, do you think that this is the kind of thing that could be replicated in other high schools to try to reach students beyond just Central High?
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly believe in this program, and you know, it's one of the reasons why I've come back year after year. I've also developed great friendships with a lot of the other mentors, and not only do I believe, you know, my primary role is to serve as a mentor in the classroom, but now, you know, myself as a more seasoned mentor, I feel like it's also my job to serve as a mentor to the new mentors coming aboard, because I know how intimidated I was my first day of walking into high school. It felt literally like my first day of high school, being that intimidated. What was I going to wear? What were the students going to think of me? You know, what were they going to just like be on their phone or pay attention to me at all? And you know, like what credibility did I have in their eyes? But I very quickly saw that they wanted to know more about me. They wanted to get to know me. And so I was hooked from day one after that.
Alexis, did you find that some of your classmates were hesitant to listen to mentors to really sort of get involved with this?
Yeah, all the time, actually. It happened to be that most of the students in our classroom denied the help. They just believed that it was too good to be true, that everybody just wants something out of it for themselves. But that's what this program is all about. It makes the difference. These are volunteers that chose to be there, and we need more people and volunteers to show up and actually give somebody else that same helping hand that they received themselves one day, you know. And yeah, a lot of students did say, you know what, I don't need help, but it actually just comes to show what big of a difference they do make and how just asking for help, you know, it's hard to do for some people. It was hard for me to do, but once you accept it, you know that they're there for the right reasons. They're there to help you, and they want nothing but the best for you.
Alexis Guzman graduated from Central High School earlier this year after going through the Destination Graduation Program. He's now a business operations student at the Maricopa Skills Center. We also heard from Michelle Donati, who's in her fourth year as a mentor in the program. You may recognize her voice from her day job at AAA Arizona.
The Arizona Coyotes have one of the NHL's hottest young players as they try to establish a foothold among hockey fans in the Valley. As the show's Phil Latzman reports, his story of facing off against a chronic disease and his special relationship with man's best friend is serving as an inspiration.
Max Domi streaks around the ice during practice at Gila River Arena in Glendale. The rookie left wing is only 20 years old, but he's grown up quickly, both as a hockey player and a person.
It's not easy to be a professional athlete, period. So I've learned a lot about myself and the person I can be just from learning from the disease.
That disease is type 1 diabetes, an autoimmune condition that shuts off the body's production of insulin, rendering the pancreas useless. Instead, Domi must do the organ's job himself by taking insulin shots and constantly checking his blood sugar, something he does up to 30 times a day. An underdose of insulin could make him ill. An overdose could cause him to pass out while playing. And severe low blood sugar could be potentially fatal.
Do you ever worry when you're out there on a shift that you might go low or you're feeling a little lightheaded and thinking, can I finish the shift?
Yeah, I mean, that obviously sometimes that happens, but you try and learn as much as you can, and the training staff is great, so they make sure that doesn't really happen.
Domi was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes when he was just 12 years old, but it didn't stop him from rising in the ranks of Canadian junior hockey in his native Ontario. One of his junior's teammates is now his Coyotes teammate, fellow winger Anthony Duclair.
And he's got to check himself like pretty often and make sure he's eating right and his diet has to be on point. I mean, it's really incredible how many things he's got to do during the day. And as professional players, you know, we got to take care of our body. But, you know, he's just on a different level.
Coyotes head coach Dave Tippett says Domi's affliction has simply become part of his routine.
As a player and as a person, he's learned how to deal with it. And, you know, now it's just become second nature. He gets checked on the bench during the game and gets poked in the finger. And it's just like everybody's looked at it as just normal now.
And it certainly hasn't affected his play. Domi is one of the team's leading scorers and one of the leading candidates for NHL Rookie of the Year. It also helps that Max grew up on the hockey rink. He's the son of longtime NHL enforcer Ty Domi. Tippett was involved in a few scrapes with his dad and says the younger Domi has more speed and finesse than his old man.
Yeah, they play a different style, that's for sure. But you know what? They're both, if you look at the way Max's tenacity on pucks and getting involved in the game, they do it a different way, but both of them have an effect on the game.
Off the ice, Max Domi has a best friend named Orion. He's a yellow lab that serves as a constant companion, helping this coyote control his diabetes.
So he's a service dog, and he can actually sense my blood sugar gets out of range, and he alerts me, and he's right 99.9% of the time. So
how does he know?
I mean, you give off a scent in your saliva, actually, that he's been trained to pick up, and it's amazing how smart he is, and it's amazing the connection you get with your dog.
As for the connection fans in Arizona have with their hockey team, he says Coyotes fans are getting a bad rap.
It's a little different for sure. I mean, hockey's pretty much everything back in Toronto. The Maple Leafs are huge. There's all this huss and fuss about, I mean, oh, they don't get enough fans. It's whatever in Phoenix. And like, this is a great hockey market and even better place to live.
And Domi looks forward to help continuing to build on a burgeoning hockey tradition in the Valley of the Sun. In Glendale, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. Two candles are the same length. Both are lit at the same time. The first candle burns for 6 hours before it burns out. The second candle burns for 3 hours before it burns out. How much time does the first candle have to burn before it's twice the length of the second candle? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Still to come, engineering students getting real-world experience and companies getting some help.
Typically, it's the kind of projects where they really would like to do them, but they're short of resources. You know, there's only so big an R&D group in a company, and there's only so much budget.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's the show on KJZZ. Looks like we'll stay partly cloudy for the rest of this afternoon and then partly cloudy skies tonight with lows in the mid-40s. Start the weekend tomorrow with partly sunny skies and a high of 74. Currently, it's partly cloudy and 72 at KJZZ. A couple of accidents to tell you about on the Valley freeways. Both around Central Phoenix, the 202 westbound at the 51 and also I-10 westbound at 24th Street, HOV lane is blocked there. It's 2:37.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners and catered party trays, fine wines paired with artisan cheeses, and festive desserts for all your entertaining needs. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. New developments in the investigation of the deadly mass shooting in San Bernardino, California. Here's FBI official David Bowditch.
As of today, based on the information and the facts as we know them, we are now investigating these horrific acts as an act of terrorism. We have uncovered evidence that has led us to learn of extensive planning.
Bowditch is assistant director of the FBI's Los Angeles office. 14 people were killed when Saeed Farouk and his wife, Tashfeen Malik, opened fire Wednesday on a holiday party for Farouk's co-workers. The shooters died hours later in a gun battle with police. A federal source tells NPR that Malik had pledged allegiance to ISIS in a Facebook post. FBI Director James Comey says so far there's no indication the two were part of a terror cell, network, or larger group. In Richmond, Virginia, Russian national Irek Hamildoun has been sentenced to life plus 30 years for supporting Taliban terrorists in an attack against U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Details from Charles Fishburne with member station WCVE.
The case is unprecedented.
The judge was in uncharted waters.
Carl Tobias, law professor at the University of Richmond.
He's the first person from the conflicts in that part of the world to be tried in a U.S. federal court.
Hamidoulin was found guilty in August of providing material support to terrorism and conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction in a 2009 attack against U.S. forces on the Afghan border. Hamidoulin says, "I do not accept your law."
Other judges have to try similar cases. We'll, of course, watch it as well.
For NPR News, I'm Charles Fishburne in Richmond.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 360. This is NPR.
This week's Paris Climate Talks have again brought climate change front and center in the international conversation. One place already experiencing damage from climate change is the Pacific island nation of Vanuatu. A lengthy archipelago which is poor and vulnerable has been experiencing the kind of weather extremes scientists attribute in part to global warming.
First came a devastating cyclone in March, and now it's facing a drought. The BBC's Matthew Price has this report.
Well, here in a temporary church in Tekara village on the north of Vanuatu's Efati Island is a group of women and children, and they're practicing Christmas carols because they've got a carol service coming up in a couple of weeks' time. And they're practicing in a open-air temporary church made of corrugated iron, roughly bolted together, because the permanent church was destroyed when a cyclone swept through this village just at the beginning of the year.
My name is Chief Damata Tarma Benjamin, and I am one of the chief in this village.
Did you have a lot of buildings that were destroyed?
Yes, only left 3 houses was left in this village.
It's a simple existence here. It's also a precarious one. Tekara sits on a beautiful stretch of coast along which the sea is rising by 6 millimetres a year. It sounds minuscule, but it is enough over time to have increased the height of the storm surges and high tides, enough to have convinced them here that Tekara has no future. They want to move the entire village.
We don't want to lose our generation in this village, so we have to relocate. Park somewhere about 300 to 400 meters away. We're gonna move them before somebody dies.
Vanuatu is a country spread out over hundreds of kilometers of this part of the Pacific Ocean. There are more than 80 islands that make up the nation, and I'm traveling between two of them at the moment on a small launch. This was already an impoverished and isolated country even before the problems associated with climate change started to hit.
What they're suffering right now, it's our emissions that have created this situation for them.
Britt Basil is a climate change advisor working in Vanuatu. The big threat, she says, is not the rising sea levels, it's the increase in extreme weather events.
If the rains don't come and they can't get a big enough crop, they're not going to eat. Or if they have to fish too much to be able to sell those fish to be able to buy rice because they're not producing enough crops, it destroys the entire system.
We were thinking that if we have money, we can build something on the side of the water to block the sea to come ashore.
This is John Kalmatak. He lives here on the fairly remote island of Nuna, and he's 76 years old. He's lived here all his life.
Before we've got rain nearly all the year round, but this time, no.
What do you think needs to be done about it? You'll be aware of this summit in Paris. What do you think your country needs from the rest of the world?
I think we need support from the big countries like England or France or America or where. We need your help.
The village football team is training for a match that they have this weekend. Half of them are barefoot. Richer countries may have the money to deal with many of the effects of global warming, but they don't here. And that is a big challenge for the negotiators in Paris.
The BBC's Matthew Price reporting from the South Pacific.
Have you ever noticed when you're driving that anyone who's driving slower than you is an idiot? And anyone driving faster than you is a maniac!
Say, look at this idiot here. Will you just look at this idiot just creeping along? Whoa, look at that maniac go!
If you're regularly cruising on the Loop 101 in the Valley, it may not surprise you to learn that a recent study put together by CarInsuranceComparison.com reports Arizona has the sixth worst drivers in the nation. So how does that affect how much we pay for coverage? Patrick Schmid, Director of Research at the Insurance Research Council, says our costs aren't bad.
They're a little bit lower than the U.S. average. The average person in Arizona is paying $781 annually to insure a vehicle, while the U.S. average is about $815.
Are there any factors to which we can attribute that?
Well, the overall market in Arizona has become more competitive, meaning there's more insurers competing for business, which is one of the reasons actually average insurance expenditures are down. It's actually in Arizona, they're down 12% from a decade prior. So competitive forces are pushing expenditures down. And of course, the economy has improved a bit since the recession. Unemployment rates within the state have trended back to the mean. But there's cost drivers as well. Bodily injury claim frequency, meaning how often people are injured and claim insurance claims, that's down about 20% from a decade prior, which is a good sign. And uninsured motorists within the state, that's often an issue for many states. And for Arizona, they're actually below the national average in terms of what percentage of motorists are uninsured. We estimate that 11% of Arizona motorists are uninsured. So there's some of the good signs for the state. Some of the negative aspects are along the lines of the severity of injuries, injury claims within the state. Severity is up about 40% over the decade prior. Some claiming activity has resulted in use of specialized care like MRIs, CT scans, which are expensive and can factor into the rising severity.
As automobiles become, well, we hope safer as high technology comes more into effect. But when you think about trends, are there factors that might come into effect in the marketplace or in just as far as automobiles are concerned that might indicate to us what trends and what might affect things going forward as far as whether rates go up, stay the same, go down?
That's a great question. I think one of the things that's, you know, relatively new are telematic devices, which are supplanted in cars, but also a lot of the guidance systems that we have installed in vehicles now. These types of systems have already made large progress within the auto field and in terms of auto insurance as well. As I was mentioning before, you know, the state of Arizona has witnessed a decline in how often they're experiencing claims, and that's not out of the norm. The United States as a whole is experiencing much lower claim frequency, and that's obviously a very good thing. We don't want people involved in accidents frequently. As technology evolves, hopefully the trend will continue to point downwards in terms of how often people are involved in claims. And if that's the case, we should continue to see an improvement in auto insurance affordability over time.
Patrick Schmid is Director of Research at the Insurance Research Council.
A Silicon Valley company's Arizona labs have been running afoul of regulators. Theranos offers blood tests directly to consumers without a doctor's order and has also developed proprietary finger prick technology. Ken Altucker covers healthcare for the Arizona Republic and has been covering the controversy. And Ken, let's start off. What is Theranos?
Theranos is a startup company that was based out of Palo Alto, California. Essentially what it is it's a blood testing company that has developed a technology that it believes can really revolutionize this area of healthcare.
This company has been running into some problems. Where did they start? What was sort of the first problem that Theranos was dealing with?
Well, they've been in Arizona since 2013, late 2013, when they began opening up their laboratories, actually their testing centers, wellness centers, they call them, inside Walgreens stores. They're up to 40 Walgreens locations now in Metro Phoenix. And in addition to this testing technology that they have, one of their claims to fame is that they're very transparent in their pricing. That's sort of their beginning trouble. Well, the Wall Street Journal reported a couple of months back some issues brought up by company insiders, actually former employees, who raised issues with the technology that Theranos is developing.
It seems like Theranos has also had some problems with both federal and state health officials, sort of in addition to those original problems, yes?
Right. They've, as a lab, they're regulated under something that's called CLIA in the industry. So they're subject to periodic inspections under CLIA. In Arizona, it's done by the Arizona Department of Health Services. So inspectors come in, and if they do find an issue, they'll note it. These are what the company will describe as sort of routine inspections, and there's nothing there that they say is out of the ordinary. Probably their bigger challenge is their proprietary technology, because that's really what has propelled this company into, you know, its valuation.
So has the controversy and some of the scrutiny that the company has faced from regulators affected its operations, affected its profitability, affected how much it will be able to do in Arizona?
Well, we certainly don't know. They're a privately owned company, so we really don't know about their profitability. We do know they have investors that have supported the company. We don't know at this point whether how much money they're making, how many tests they are performing, although in their inspection documents that the Arizona Department of Health Services, it gave a figure of over 1.3 million tests expected in the Phoenix area. So, you know, the question is, what will consumers think? And, you know, I've heard from a lot of consumers who are going out there getting tests done, and the news really hasn't affected their decision.
Ken Alltucker covers healthcare for the Arizona Republic. Ken, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news at 2:51.
KJZZ is supported by Cityscape, announcing the Cityscape Downtown Ice Rink, open midday and evenings now through January 11th. Hourly light shows, tickets, and more at phxicerink.com.
ASU's Fulton Schools of Engineering are hosting their innovation showcase starting next hour on the Polytechnic campus in Mesa. It's a chance for students to show off the projects they've been working on for the past two semesters in collaboration with a company that's identified a problem it's looking to solve. John Parsi is the director of e-projects at ASU Polytechnic.
These are projects that are linked directly to a company like Honeywell or ON Semiconductor or Microchip, General Dynamics, companies at that scale, and also a number of smaller companies, for example, like Pure Grips, a company in Mesa that makes the golf grips for a variety of customized applications.
How do you and how do your students find out what these companies need, where sort of the need in the market is?
Okay, that's actually kind of a unique aspect to the Polytechnic School approach to this. Myself, I go out and I solicit projects from companies, and we get together and we ask them to present a project to the students. The students are not going out soliciting or creating a project. Rather, they're looking for a company giving them a project that is something they want to get done, and they propose the project. We put them together. They agree to work together, and away they go.
Are these projects that the companies would be able to do without being involved with ASU? I mean, are these things that their R&D budgets would permit them to do?
Possible, but typically it's the kind of projects where they really would like to do them, but they're short of resources. You know, there's only so big an R&D group in a company, and only so much budget. So what you can do here is they leverage a relatively small investment, and they can get a lot back for it.
Have you found that companies have smaller R&D budgets now? I mean, are firms more reliant on projects like this now than they were in the past?
Some, particularly the smaller companies, because they don't have a lot of excess capital. And, they can use this, as I mentioned, to leverage it very, very heavily into accomplishing things they just don't have time for.
John Parsi is director of e-projects at ASU's Polytechnic. Today's expo will feature more than 50 projects. Samantha Janko worked on one of them. The senior is a robotics student, and she'll be graduating in about a week.
We built a containerized microgrid system for disaster relief. So basically, you take a ton of solar panels and you pack them away in a 20-foot shipping container with a generator and a set of batteries. And it's deployable in under 2 hours, so you can send it somewhere and have some people lay out the panels and plug everything in, and it can provide up to 20 kilowatts of power.
Which company were you working with on this?
Oh, we were working with NRG Renew. They're based up in Scottsdale.
When you first heard about this project, what went through your mind as far as how you could make it happen, whether you could make it happen?
Oh, well, I knew immediately that it was going to be a lot of benchmarking, you know, looking through components and a lot of learning in that we needed to fill in the gaps of our knowledge about electrical engineering in terms of big systems, high voltage, high current. And I knew that we would have to work as a team to reach their goals and be able to make everything work out in the end.
Did you think that the final product would look like the one that you ended up with when you were starting?
Actually, yes. This was the one project where the design actually turned into the final product quite well.
What do you think that you're getting out of working on this project? I mean, how will this help you going forward?
Oh, it'll absolutely help me in terms of experience, you know, working with this industry, this industrial company, and working with professionals who are able to answer our questions, and definitely teamwork, being able to split up the work and have long days and getting things done by deadlines and making sure that in the end you get a product that both the sponsor and the team are happy with.
Do you think that what you created is ready to be deployed? I mean, are there things that you still need to do to make sure that when a disaster hits, it's ready to go?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely needs some more work. This is definitely a prototype. It's a proof of concept that it actually can be done. And of course, it was built over pretty much the course of last semester. So it was built in a very short period of time. And I think with some well thought out changes and some advice from professionals who manufacture these types of products, you know, it could definitely use some improvements. But it's the basic design is there for sure.
ASU senior Samantha Janko was one of the participants in this afternoon's innovation showcase on the school's Polytechnic campus.
It was designed as a winter retreat in the early 1930s. Later, it was abandoned. Today, the property is among the most unique structures in the area, and it's been restored for the public. The show's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us on a tour.
Perched on a slope off College Avenue and near Curry Road in Tempe is an adobe structure. It's been known for decades as the Eisendrath House. It was built during the Great Depression. Did you know the Eisendrath House was built after the owner was refused boarding because of her background?
The Rose Eisendrath House, the complex that she had constructed in 1929 to 1930, and this was her own private resort.
City of Tempe architect Mark Vinson takes me on a tour of the 85-year-old home.
As the story goes, she was not invited to stay in at least one of the local valley resorts because of her Jewish background in those days.
Rose Eisendrath purchased more than 40 acres of land north of the Salt River in the area we know today as Papago Park. She decided to build the home on a hill overlooking the valley, mountains, and the Sonoran Desert as far as the eyes could see.
You could imagine the the views in 1929, 1930, when there was nothing between here and the Superstition Mountains.
Materials were scarce during the Great Depression, so the home was constructed out of mud adobe blocks, materials actually gathered out of the Salt River nearby, among other resources. Look up at the ceiling wooden beams and you get the idea.
We're looking at some of the original vigas in the ceiling, and actually some of these were, many of them were actually recycled telephone or telegraph poles.
Vincent says many aspects of the building were strategically designed, like the rooms have multiple windows for ventilation. The house is a two-story adobe residence, a rare architectural design.
Probably one of the best examples in the state of the Pueblo Revival style of architecture, the irregular massing, the use of exposed vigas to resemble earlier prehistoric Native American construction. And so it's very representative of that style, and probably one of the best and largest residential examples of that style in the whole state.
Rose Eisendrath lived in the home until 1936, when she died. The property has had many owners over the years. Modifications have been made to the property, and most of the land has been sold. In the early 2000s, the city of Tempe acquired the remaining 9-acre property and the home and boarded it up until recently.
She used this for entertaining. She had many acquaintances and associates, and family members would come out. So this was a lively place for the years that Rose was here.
And that's the idea behind making the adobe home a place for the community. The property is now the Eisendrath Center for Water Conservation, where water sustainability education classes are held for city residents. It's also a historical site for touring and a special events venue. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we ought to know, please tell us about them. You can reach us at the show at kjzz.org.
Mark, if you, like I, are looking for things to do on the weekend,
yes.
Well, how about Tanya Tucker, Mark? She's playing tonight at Wild Horse Pass Hotel and Casino, well-known for her longtime relationship with Glenn Campbell.
Interesting. If you don't want to do that, you can also see Snoop Dogg tonight at Live Wire in Scottsdale.
Nice contrast.
Yeah.
Yeah. The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Regina Rebozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shannon, Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. The managing editor, Tracy Greer. Our news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the sunny one, Hoban.
This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. All Things Considered is next. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.